If you like mysteries, we've got a good one for you. A 600-year-old mystery, to be specific, the Voynich Manuscript, which some have called the Elegant Enigma, a strange book with strange drawings of plants and people that no one's ever been able to quite figure out until now. Professor Bax, our guest, Dr. Stephen Bax and Stuart Davis, join me in just a moment to tell us what progress has been made and what we now know about what the manuscript might mean. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Professor Bax, let's jump right into it. You've been working at this for something like 18, 19 months, and you sort of had a breakthrough. Tell me how it came about and what you think it means.
Well, yes, as Stuart mentioned earlier, the key thing for me is to look for proper names in the manuscript, and that follows previous people's work, for example, on Egyptian hieroglyphs, where people knew the name of Cleopatra and the name of Ramesses as pharaohs of Egypt. So they looked for those in the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs and gradually managed to work out from that the letters and the sounds of each of these things and then build up the picture from there. So I decided to have a go at this with the Voynich and started with, particularly there's a really interesting page of the Voynich which is like a circle full of stars. And in the middle you've got a picture of the moon with a rather sad face in it, a beautiful sad face. Then the top left-hand corner you've got seven stars clustered together. Now, previously, some people have suggested maybe this is the name the Pleiades because of the famous seven stars, the seven sisters are sometimes called the Pleiades. Yeah. And others have said, well, maybe it's the name Taurus because the Pleiades are in the constellation of Taurus. So I took the second option and looked at the word which seemed to be Taurus and identified letters in other words for plant names in particular and gradually built up this the idea that it was actually Ta-a-wa-ra. And the last letter is an N, as I believe, so something like Taurun. And the, I mean, on its own, that would just be speculation, but linking it with other names through the manuscript allows us to build up a gradual picture where each one seems to support the other. Now, of course, some of them might be wrong, but I think that's the basic approach I use to try and get some kind of progress in the manuscript.
And where are we? Where do things stand?
Well, I've identified around about 10 now since I published my article and the first video on the internet. We've got two more. So I think around about 12 words, which I think are pretty solid, mostly names of plants, but also the name, for example, of Taurus, the constellation. And that's, I mean, the words in themselves are not important. The key thing is to build up the letters. So then we can start reading words we don't know. So although we've still got, I would say, probably 2 years or something more to do that. We're generally, I think, on the way to doing that, gradually cracking the link between the sounds and the signs. And then the next step, of course, is to try and find out what the language is underneath all of this script.
I guess one of the problems is identifying the plants themselves, because the drawings are really great, but it's not exactly clear what the plants are in each of these drawings, right?
Absolutely, and some people have said they're obviously alien plants from Mars. Can I illustrate that, George, with a really interesting example? Very recently, there was a case of two scientists here in the States, actually, who identified them as probably Mexican plants, and they were 100% sure about this. But yet, 2 or 3 years ago, there was another very well-respected biologist from France who identified them again with 100% certainty as Indian or Asian plants. So that just shows the difficulty of, you know, even experts can't really agree on what these plants actually are. So you're absolutely right. That's one of the problems.
So you having a couple of letters, you've gotten a lot of feedback, of course, about this. Have anybody come up with a good argument why you might be wrong?
Well, surprisingly not. I mean, I hope that what people would do would be to work through the arguments and basically point, you know, things that might be wrong here and things wrong there. And some people have, you know, very kindly suggested different aspects of plants and so on. But substantially, no one's actually unpicked all the bits that I've mentioned. I mean, some people have said, one person wrote to me and said, Dr. Bax, you know, you've written a 58-page article. I've read the first 3 pages and I think it's absolute rubbish. And then he spent another 10 pages telling me why it was rubbish. Well, you know, it's very kind of him, but if you'd only actually read the whole thing, I think you might actually appreciate it more. So, you know, I mean, that highlights the point that you made earlier, that there are people who are very skeptical and who aren't really keen to kind of engage with the argument. But although I'm happy to say that some of the argument is probably wrong, there are probably things that need tweaking, I think the key thing, as I think Stuart mentioned earlier, is to have a kind of interested, dispassionate debate and try together as a community to try and build towards some progress.
So you've got a couple of letters. You think they know, you know what those letters are. What's the next step? Then you go through the manuscript and identify where those letters are. Use them as building blocks to figure out what the other letters and other words might mean.
Exactly. And try to get more of the letters because we haven't got all of them yet. A really good example was actually recently I was on the Reddit website. I did an open forum there. And then while I was doing that, somebody emailed me with a really good suggestion for one of the plants. And he said he and his brother had got together and they were sure that this plant was the castor oil plant. Ricinus communis is the Latin name. And he gave some really convincing arguments for it and identified the name and said, I think that name could well be linked to the Arabic name for this plant. You know, I followed your method, Dr. Bax, and so on. And I researched that for the following 2 weeks, and I'm sure he's absolutely right on that. And that, for me, is the kind of beauty of, in a sense, putting this out there, even though it's still provisional and speculative. You know, I'm starting to get other people who can contribute. Obviously, I can't do it all, and it's really great to get that kind of contribution to do exactly as you said, link to try and get more letters and more words and gradually find out what the language is underneath.
That was one of the things I saw when I first read about your work, is there was an Arabic a word for a plant that you were sort of stuck on for a while, RR or something like that.
That's right, absolutely, yes. Funnily enough, that's actually one of the ones I'm less convinced by, because the ones I'm more convinced by are where the plant is really clearly identified by independent people, not by me, by plant specialists. And then the first word on the page seems to be really clearly identifiable and decodable, because in medieval manuscripts, that's where the name of the plant would normally be, the very first word. So that's the one that you mentioned, the arar one, which is the Arabic word for juniper. I'm slightly unsure about that because the arar doesn't figure as the first word on the same page. So I'm prepared to kind of be a bit skeptical about that. But that doesn't actually change the particular sounds in the word arar because they occur in other words as well. But I think that indicates, that illustrates the importance of the method, is to get a really good plant identification and then work really hard to see if the first word can be seen to be the name of that plant. And if not, then I think to move on to something else. Because if you just chose any word on the page, you could start imagining all kinds of things, and that's obviously very bad methodology.
Sure. Stuart, Dr. Bax, I think, is being kind of modest in describing what an amazing accomplishment this is. Why don't you tackle that and tell me how important you think it might be for him to even have gotten this far?
Well, I think it's, you know, the strong argument right out of the gate on that is that we have had 6 centuries of unsuccessful approaches on this subject. And yeah, I mean, Professor Bax is modest and wonderful and all that, but I think that even with the initial steps of the decoding underway and this, you know, a dozen or so words being cracked initially and a few letters coming in, that is 100% more than any person in 6 centuries has had success in cracking. And I think we are going to be present at a great gift opening, well, because we're alive at the time when this manuscript can possibly be revealed. So I think that's really important, just to say that, first of all, success is the first and singular instance in the history of this manuscript. There's never been another success. There's been many other pronouncements and people that have commandeered the manuscripts to advance their own personal agendas at various times in history. But this is something completely other. And not only is he having success with it, one of the things that I am personally moved by is the way that he has immediately turned the manuscript to the public and attempted to crowdsource and include other people. As I said before, in the spirit of knowing that really this is an endowment for humanity, if we can get this manuscript revealed. So I think that the success is 100% more than has ever happened before. And what we could potentially gain from it is not just the decoding of a manuscript, because that in itself is special and momentous, but there's something singular about this manuscript. And we know that before it's been deciphered, because this script does not exist anywhere else. Whatever the confluence of factors and events was in the mixture of cultures, the historical upheaval that may have gone into its formulation, whether something was being coded or not, etc., what we know is that this script doesn't exist anywhere else. And so if we do crack this code and we do get into this book, the rich, multifaceted nature of its contents are not only going to be revealed, but we're going to get a peek at excavating a reality that we've never had disclosed before from this period in human history. So it's a big deal, and no one's done it before. And I think that the way he is doing it is in the spirit of what's in all of our best interests. It's in the spirit of the human endowment of knowledge.
Is there, Dr. Bax, is there sort of a continental claims to the manuscript? Like people wanted to be a European language, or people wanted to be an Asian-based language kind of a thing? Competition on that level?
Absolutely, there is. I'll tell you a good example of that. I was interviewed a week and a half ago by people from Russian television. I have to emphasize they were independent Russian television, not a government-backed one. And they were determined to ask me about whether there was a secret map of the Kremlin within the document, because they'd had an idea that somebody had mentioned them. There's some lovely little buildings with nice onion domes on them, which look very Russian. And so I think exactly as you say, everyone would like to kind of claim this. But in a way, that's not a bad thing, because you know who knows, it may actually be some form of old Russian in the end. And the more people who get into it and have a look at it and investigate it, the more kind of minds we get onto the case, and I think the more likely we are to decipher it, as long as we're fairly level-headed about it and basically don't just take every claim at face value and go through it really steadily and responsibly, which I think is what we're trying to do. Then I think the more ideas we get flowing in, the better.
So as Stuart said, you know, it doesn't appear anywhere else, not in any other kind of manuscript or any other kind of writing. It's not written on the walls anywhere. Do you suspect then it is a dead language, that it was an actual language for a while and it just died out?
Well, I mean, it is very interesting from that point of view, because all the other unidentified or undecoded scripts we have got several different examples. Like there's a wonderful one called Rongo Rongo from Easter Island, where we've got quite a few little examples around the island, but very small, short texts. Well, the Voynich is pretty well unique in that there's a huge amount of text. There's something like 35,000 words, but only in this one manuscript. There's no other example we've found anywhere else in the world. So for that reason, it is pretty peculiar and very interesting. I'm not sure. I think it's fair to say it's an extinct script. What I'm hoping is that the language underneath it is not extinct, that still there are examples of it around in modern forms, or maybe the dialect has died out, but we've got other dialects from the same language that still exist. If it's actually a language that's died out, then it's going to be very, very difficult to interpret it. But I myself, from my own decoding so far, I think there are clues in it that point to it being perhaps a language that is still alive, but obviously written with a very different script nowadays.
Well, what do you think about what it is? Some sort of a medical journal, an encyclopedia, a how-to guide for, herbal medicines? What do you think?
Well, all of those have been suggested. I mean, some people think that all the naked women in it must mean it's some sort of contraceptive manual of some sort. But
or porn. It's early porn.
Well, when you look at some of the figures, you don't think it wouldn't be very exciting porn, I have to say. But I think for me, also some people are very intrigued by the idea that it's got some elements of witchcraft or alchemy within it. But actually, there's not very much of that. There aren't any pictures of devils or strange rituals or rites. It seems to be more of a kind of straightforward treatise about nature, but quite an in-depth treatise about nature. And even those naked women, as I mentioned before, are thought perhaps to be a symbol of plant physiology. Somebody basically describing nature so that other people can learn from it. So the best suggestion I would have is that it is some sort of treatise on nature.
I remember reading about hieroglyphics, Egyptian hieroglyphics, and there were people, scientists, esteemed people, who back in the day would say, this is all gibberish, there's no language here. And yet they were proven to be wrong. Is it a fair comparison?
Well, I think it is, actually. And I think in every case like this, the danger is that when people try for so long, they start to give up. And then they start to say, oh, no, it's just mumbo-jumbo, or it's just gibberish, and so on. But I think, the proper way to do it is to keep going optimistically, try all avenues patiently, keep trying things that haven't been tried. I heard you about an hour ago talking about the Malaysian plane issue, and you mentioned, well, why don't we expand the discussion? Current approaches haven't worked yet, and I think exactly the same with the Voynich. I think we need to try and expand the discussion, get other ideas in. For example, not just assume that it's a European language. I suspect now that it's actually probably an Asian language, West Asian language, from the decoding that I've done so far. And I think we've got to consider that kind of possibility.
Are you surprised by the explosion of general interest? I mean, this is an academic exercise. It's pretty obscure. A lot of, A lot of people know about the Voynich manuscript, but millions and millions of other people do not. They have no idea why anyone should care about it, and you've been interviewed all over the world.
Yeah, yes, but I think it's like the success of your show as well. People love a mystery. They love something interesting, something that's got an element of the unknown to it, and especially something that's so visually beautiful as this and so kind of historically interesting. It's got a lot of intrigue to it, and there's still a lot of intrigue there. I mean, it could be still some kind of secret code hiding a real language, or it could just be a kind of natural human script that's lost and died out. So there's still a lot of mystery there, which I think keeps people coming back to it again and again.
Same question to you, Stuart. Are you surprised by the interest in the work of a linguist in England who's trying to crack this 600-year-old manuscript?
I'm not. I mean, personally, I think that we underestimate the intelligence and nuance that the general public has toward these kinds of topics. And again, I do think your show is an example of that people are intrinsically magnetized towards something like this because it includes so much of the human experience. And as Dr. or Professor Wax was saying, that if it's a compendium on nature, if it's a treatise on nature in some way, then we as human beings being immersed in that atmosphere know that this is a book about much of our immediate experience. So to me, it's kind of a no-brainer. Number one, the mystery of it, the impenetrability, it demands our attention. It's beautiful. I mean, this is a captivating manuscript, even though we can't read a single word of it when we've approached it through its history. It's beautiful and entrancing. So, I've always personally felt that we do underestimate the general public's interest and vitality in exploring these kinds of things. And, personally, I wish there were a lot more shows like yours in all variety of the media that would just throw something like this out, let people determine for themselves. And I think in this instance with the Voynich, we're seeing clearly in communicated what level of interest there is. There's a great level of interest for this obscure esoteric manuscript from the 1500s. Why is that? Because we love a mystery and we love these vast interiors that are being potentially unveiled because of Professor Bax.
Professor, I know you're going to be leaving us here in about 2 minutes, so tell us now where it goes from here. You said it might take another 2 years of hard work to figure out all the words in the manuscript, and then 5 or more years to figure out the language after that.
Yes, I'm thinking, probably optimistically actually, I hope that we'll make some progress on the kind of script and the letters. And it may be that we have a breakthrough sooner than that where we can actually identify and say, this is the language that's actually underneath it. But I'm trying to be a bit kind of measured about it, and I think probably a few more years to go. Certainly, I would say probably at least 8 years before we get anything like a translation, and that's kind of looking on the bright side. But I would just say to people, as we've said before, if they want to go to my website, which is stephenbax.net, there's a kind of open forum there for people to kind of put their own ideas, to give their own contributions. If they know something about plants, they can help us with the plant identification. I think it just is a genuinely interesting opportunity for people to get involved, to have a few ideas, and basically we'll try and solve it together.
Yeah, and using the progress that you've made already, this remarkable work, you might have a whole heck of a lot of people working on your team and crack this a lot sooner than you think.
Hope so. I'd love that to be the case, because, I mean, there's a lot in the manuscript. If you look through it, every page has some curious, odd things, intriguing things. So there's plenty to work on, actually.
There might be a cure for diseases or something like that in there.
Well, actually, I mean, that's not too far-fetched, because a lot of old manuscripts with plant remedies are now being studied quite intensively for the insights that they can actually bring to modern medicine. So I think, as Stuart said right at the very beginning, this is not an irrelevant manuscript. There could be wisdom and ideas and things of interest which could still be of use today.
Dr. Stephen Bax, thanks very much for joining us. Fascinating work. We congratulate you on the progress you made so far and hope you'll come back again and keep us informed.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, everyone. Stuart Davis will stick around with us. We have a lot more to talk about with him. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. We have much more to cover here on Coast to Coast tonight. Stuart Davis is my guest for the rest of the evening. In the next hour, we will open up the phone lines with your questions for him. Going to talk about his music as well as his own language, one that he has created that probably in the course of creating it taught him a lot about how the work that goes into cracking the code of the Voynich manuscript. I want to ask him, too, what this thing might be worth if he even put it on the market. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Stuart Davis is here, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the Voynich manuscript. Any idea, Stuart, what this thing would be worth if it even were on the open market?
A lot. An unbelievable fortune. I think that, you know, using the reference of Rudolph Payne, that equivalent roughly of $100,000 for it in today's money back then, that was far before its storied history, and the momentum of its enigma has grown over these centuries. So I think, first of all, just the fact that it's a one-of-a-kind, standalone document. As you said, the script doesn't exist. It's not written on walls. There's no other instances of it that we've located anywhere in materials. So it's a one-of-a-kind, a standalone, and the nature of its illustrated visual component, I think, multiplies the value. I'm not an auctioning estimate expert, but I think, if you know, some corollaries might be like the James Audubon book, which was an illustrated Birds of America kind of thing that is more modern, and that was I think maybe around $10 million US or something. So very, very hard to say, but I think it would be an exorbitant fortune. And that kind of ties back with what I find baffling in the story of this manuscript, is that I'd like to know why it wouldn't sell in the early 1900s or mid-1900s when an attempt was made. Before this went to Yale, it was on the auction block. You know, they brought it around and tried to find a buyer for it and couldn't, which seems really strange to me. And that's a part of its story that I haven't been able to find a sufficient explanation for. But I think today, if it were to go up on one of the major auctioning blocks, it would be a fortune, you know, definitely in the millions.
You've read the whole thing. I mean, have you been through it page by page?
I've gone through it very carefully, page by page. I mean, I have read it, you know, putting that word in quotes, of course, because it's inscrutable. But it's a very hypnotic experience. I'm sure that you have as well dived into it a bit. And when I was putting together my interview with Professor Bax, I started flipping through those pages in a virtual sense online, and I could not stop. And what ended up happening is that I scanned every single page of the entire manuscript, and I spent about 7 days poring over the minutiae and detail of it. And it's an interesting psychological phenomenon when a person does that, because why are we so engrossed in something that's, you know, you would think it would lose its sway after an hour or a day or whatever, but it seems to build. And so, yeah, I've gone through it page by page, and I just left that experience even more excited and moved by whatever might be in there, and really happy to be, like I said, alive at a time when I think we might get to see this thing revealed. One thing that'd be fun to ask Professor Bax when he comes back next time is, what is the critical threshold that we need to cross over in technology with, as he said, garbage in, garbage out on using a computer right now to analyze this script? However, with the progress that he has made, even these few letters and a dozen or so words, pretty soon I would imagine we're going to get into a territory when you're not dealing with just garbage anymore and you can put the information into computing systems. Then you get meta-analysis that I would hope would accelerate the decoding of the manuscript by a few years at least.
Yeah,
so,
I was thinking the same thing. You know, you know, before you had any of the letters, you that wouldn't work. But now that you've got some, it would seem to be worth it, taking another crack at it.
Yeah, and then also, are they going to be able to, or will they be interested in keeping this stuff behind the curtain? So what will the temptation be to announce, you know, we've decoded this section of the book, or these phrases, or this paragraph, because, as you said, the popular interest in this is really quite strong, and the passion among those interested, I think, is extraordinary as well. It's unusual. And so every sentence, every word that comes through the translation, people are waiting around to hear. I count myself in that population, actually. So I wonder if they'll work behind the scenes, as often occurs with ancient manuscripts. They like, scholars like to wait until they're very sure and have corroborated. That doesn't seem quite to jive with the public approach that Bax has taken. I mean, I love the fact that he's put this out to try to crowdsource the wisdom and intellect of the planet, but at the same time, it's going to make it a little bit more of a messy affair while it's being deciphered.
Well, it's encouraging that he's not, I'm cracking the code and I'm not going to tell anybody what I've done so far. I'm going to print it in a book and you all have to buy it, you know?
I just think that's so wonderful. I would love to see a renaissance, you know, pun intended, of that spirit in approaching these kinds of subjects, because, you know, the polymath approach to cosmology and the hermetic principles of knowledge and transformation, and whether or not they're directly involved in this manuscript, the way that Professor Bax is approaching this is an approach and a tone that I really think we would all benefit from restoring in a more popular sense. There's so much acrimony and bitterness, and I think that anything that goes online anymore is automatically liable to be taken, you know, attacked by trolls, and there's all this kind of acrimony on the internet. And I think that often that dissuades people from taking this kind of work and making these kind of moves that Professor Bax is making. And I hope people would be encouraged and other scholars would be encouraged to continue in the love of wisdom and the discovery of this manuscript. And so, yeah, maybe it's a trend. Maybe this would be the beginning of a trend toward that good-spirited openness.
Why do you suppose it is that he was able to make the progress that he's made and somebody else didn't do it? I mean, the steps he took were fairly logical in their approach. It seems like after 600 years that someone would have taken the same crack at it.
I think that it probably comes down to his knowledge of Arabic, which was perhaps his knowledge of Arabic, along with the other facets of the manuscript that he was talking with, were notches in the tumbler that had just not fallen into place before. But again, I think another key feature is that this manuscript was available to him online, and there probably have been figures previously in history that had the jumble of skills and the mix of gifts that he has, but they didn't have access to the manuscript online as he does. So maybe the advent of the web is the piece that was missing all this time, and so that minds equipped with the right skills can now finally encounter this manuscript in numbers that they couldn't before. And so we're going to see an avalanche, and the whole side of the thing's going to come down.
We should remind people that they can see this online as well. Yale University has put this, it has a manuscript library, and it's put it online. If you go to Professor Bax's website, we've got the link on the Coast to Coast website. You can click on it and follow various links. You can find the Wikipedia page, which has a link to the manuscript, and you can check it out for yourself. It is, I think you would have to agree, a work of art. It's beautiful. You know, some of the images were a little bit misleading in that they show castles that a lot of people said, hey, that's a European castle. It has to be a European language, right?
Yeah, that's right, actually. There was a moment of realization that had to do with the concatenation on the top of one of the castle walls, and that was actually something that has indicated strongly. I believe that's the key feature that anchors this manuscript in northern Italy, potentially. That's the reason folks say that this was possibly or probably written from that area, because the concatenation on the castles depicted in the manuscript did not occur outside of that particular region until a much later date, if I recall correctly on all of that. And then also on the on seeing the manuscript itself, in the interview that I did with Professor Bax, which is on my website, stuartdavis.com, we did end up putting pretty much the entire manuscript into the visual, the video component of our interview. So while I'm talking with him, we put the manuscript up, and basically you can page through 240 pages of the Voynich while he talks about it. So that was a surprise turn as well. I didn't plan on doing that initially, but as you said, you start looking at this thing and you get engrossed, and I just couldn't stop. So we ended up putting it all up. And another really beautiful thing is that this is, it's intellectual property is available to all. So it's not being protected and kept behind the copyright laws that might prevent us from exploring.
Is there any indication that pages are missing, or any indication that pages are mixed up or out of order?
Yeah, there does seem to be pretty strong, I think it's generally accepted that the 240 pages that we have right now are not the original full body of the manuscript. And so at some point, there's various explanations, such as we know pages were sent from one owner to another. People who own the manuscript would be unable to decipher it, and so they would remove one page and they would send it to an authority that they thought. I know in one instance there was a gentleman who had claimed falsely to have deciphered hieroglyphics prematurely. And one of the, I think Voynich actually himself sent pages to this gentleman in the hope that he would have clues and advance the deciphering, and it didn't come to anything. But that process of taking little bits out of the manuscript and sending it around the world for analysis or to have other people look at it has probably pilfered, you know, a chunk of the book away. So yeah, some of it's gone.
Let's talk about your language. And the first question I'd ask about your language, which you have created, is a chicken and egg question. Did you create your language because of your interest in the Voynich manuscript, or was it the other way around? You became interested in that because you were working on creating your own mystery language.
The Voynich came into my life as kind of an extension of my interest in constructed languages. And so, yeah, my relationship with this language that's called IS, which is a constructed engineered language, that began as a thought experiment for me. So my history and profession as an artist and somebody who works in symbols and signifiers and in music and in other mediums as well, I paint in this language. I've spent years asking myself the question, you know, what worldview, what filters, what assumptions did I inherit when I was a native-born English speaker? In what ways is the language that I'm born into determining or influencing my perception of reality and my experience of life and the cosmos? Because for better or worse, and there's definitely both sides of the coin, a language is a set of filters. And like your family, you don't really get to choose it when you're born. So later on in life, I started to ask those questions, and one of the things I wanted to do as a thought experiment is to try to engineer a language with different filters, with a different set of assumptions and different lenses. That interest and exploration of constructed languages led me to the Voynich because I had read speculation that potentially it was an artificial or engineered language. As you know, now, any kind of speculation you can imagine has been projected on the Voynich. Everything from aliens and Mars and, you know, some kind of divinely channeled language to that's pure gibberish, etc. I think my personal take on it is in line with Professor Bax's, that it's probably a natural language with features that we just haven't discovered yet. Maybe this is the one-time instance of that script being created. But I was interested in it for that reason. And then when I found it, I just fell in love with it. So my work with the constructed language is, which by the way, there's a video that explains my constructed language on my website, stuartdavis.com, that we put up in anticipation of my talk with you today, just so we could have a visual representation that explains it in 5 minutes. That's how I came to the Voynich, and my language continues as a thought experiment.
Well, it's fascinating how intricate it became. I thought it was interesting that in the video, you talk about how a person who speaks this language naturally would think of it as blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, who speaks it naturally?
No one yet. Yeah. I've been trying to teach it to my daughters, and with some reticence and manipulation of my sensibilities, they have learned some of it. But I think what's really fascinating to me about that is that, yes, for the time being, you know, as I say in the video, my accent is horrible. I'm not a native speaker, and I never could be because it was 30-some years of English before I started to create this language. But even more interesting to me than the pronunciation are the features of the language, which are horizontal and vertical. So in a practical sense, like if you think of the fact that as a four-year-old, this is one of the things that occurred to me in English. As a four-year-old, I would use the word God, and it would signify or call to my consciousness, you know, a crude notion of this guy with a beard on a throne and a cloud, and there was that kind of very paternal anthropomorphic set of qualities with it. By the time I turned 40, that word God had completely migrated to mean something unborn and unmade and completely ineffable, with this ground of being, this fundament of reality that was inexplicable but immediate to me as a practitioner of meditation and spiritual lineages. So what I became interested about was what happens between the ages of 4 and 40, where we're using the same word, that word God, to signify completely different notions, completely different reference. So I started to try to build something into my language that would dynamically respond to that developmental or vertical conveyor belt of depth. I mean, if you think of an elevator that goes up and down a building, and maybe at 4 years old, you're on the first floor, and at 40 years old, you're maybe on the third floor or whatever. But the point is that we developed as human beings. We have that vertical chain of depth in us that expands as we grow. And we don't see that enacted in English or any of the other languages that I know of. So I've been trying to explore that in my constructed language, and then also the horizontal feature that you were referring to, which is why I have such a bad accent in the language, is that the phonemes are invertible. You can point them in multiple directions. And one direction of the word can be pointed in its opposite direction to mean the inversion. So the words and is are more like a lens or a flag that can be flown in different directions, or an arrow that you can point left or right. And if you point it left, it means up. And if you point it right, it means down. So it has this kind of horizontal and vertical axis to it.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty clever. That's pretty clever stuff. I really thought your language even reminded me more of Tolkien and Elvish than did the Voynich manuscript. And what also occurred to me is that I noticed that it lives on. Even if nobody ever speaks this language, it will live on because you incorporate it into your art very cleverly. You look really closely at some of your really good art pieces, and there it is.
Well, that has been a really emotional part of creating the language, actually, is that in a parallel way to cracking a language, you know, when you think of the intellectual and emotional forces that you bring to bear on trying to decode the Voynich manuscript and the history of all of these people putting their passion into trying to find out what it means, there's a parallel kind of experience in creating a language, which is, I'm not really interested in coming up with another word for fork or car, etc. That is really nothing of what this language has to do with. And so this language is about trying to find signifiers for human experience and parts of our interior that don't have words to them, but we do experience them. And the artwork that you're describing, which is I paint these crows and also biological plants and lotus flowers, etc. And the plumage of the crows is comprised of script and poems in this is language that I've been creating. So that's the way that I work on it. And I might work on the painting for a month, and the whole time that those crows are coming into formation, I'm learning the language that way. That's the way that the words come to me and the concepts come to me. It's like the visual artwork is the workshop where my mind and creative being, dig their hands into the mud and pull words out of the earth of that artwork.
You know, it's not evident, but there's got to be an alien in there somewhere in your background for you to arrive at this point, at this stage in your life. I hope we get a chance to explore that in the next hour. We're talking with Stuart Davis about his artwork and his new language. And coming up, we'll get to hear some of his music and talk about the spiritual experiences that led him to this point. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM.